Gildan Media, a division of Recorded Books, presents Energy and Civilization, A History, by Václav Smil, narrated by David Colacci. Preface and Acknowledgements. I finished writing Energy and World History in July 1993. The book came out in 1994, and it remained in print for two decades. Since 1994, energy studies have been through a period of great expansion, and I have added to it by publishing 9 books dealing explicitly with energy matters and a dozen interdisciplinary books with significant energy components. Consequently, once I decided to revisit this fascinating topic, it was obvious that superficial updating would not do. As a result, this is a substantially new book with a new title. The text is nearly 60% longer than the original. Boxes sprinkled throughout the book contain some surprising calculations, as well as many detailed explanations of important topics and essential tables. I have also quoted from sources ranging from the classics, Apuleius, Lucretius, Plutarch, to 19th and 20th century observers such as Braudel, Eden, Orwell, and Senancour. As is always the case with interdisciplinary studies of this kind, this book would not have been possible without the work of hundreds of historians, scientists, engineers, and economists. Winnipeg, August 2016. 1. Energy and Society. Energy is the only universal currency. One of its many forms must be transformed to get anything done. Universal manifestations of these transformations range from the enormous rotations of galaxies to thermonuclear reactions in stars. On Earth, they range from the terra-forming forces of plate tectonics that part ocean floors and raise new mountain ranges to the cumulative erosive impacts of tiny raindrops. As the Romans knew, gutta cavat lapidem non vi, sed saepe cadendo. A drop of water hollows a stone not by force, but by continually dripping. Life on Earth, despite decades of attempts to catch a meaningful extraterrestrial signal, still the only life in the universe we know of, would be impossible without the photosynthetic conversion of solar energy into phytomass, plant biomass. Humans depend on this transformation for their survival, and on many more energy flows for their civilized existence. As Richard Adams put it, "We can think thoughts wildly, but if we do not have the wherewithal to convert them into action, they will remain thoughts. History acts in unpredictable ways. Events in history, however, necessarily take on a structure or organization that must accord with their energetic components." The evolution of human societies has resulted in larger populations, a growing complexity of social and productive arrangements, and a higher quality of life for a growing number of people. From a fundamental biophysical perspective, both prehistoric human evolution and the course of history can be seen as the quest for controlling greater stores and flows of more concentrated and more versatile forms of energy, and converting them in more affordable ways, at lower costs and with higher efficiencies, into heat, light, and motion. This tendency has been generalized by Alfred Lotka, 1880 through 1949, an American mathematician, chemist, and statistician, in his Law of Maximum Energy. In every instance considered, natural selection will so operate as to increase the total mass of the organic system, to increase the rate of circulation of matter through the system, and to increase the total energy flux through the system so long as there is present an unutilized residue of matter and available energy. The history of successive civilizations, the largest and most complex organisms in the biosphere, has followed this course. Human dependence on ever higher energy flows can be seen as an inevitable continuation of organismic evolution. Wilhelm Ostwald, 1853 through 1932, recipient of the 1909 Nobel Prize in Chemistry for his work on catalysis, was the first scientist to expand explicitly the second law of energetics to all and any action, and in particular to the totality of human actions. All energies are not ready for this transformation, only certain forms which have been therefore given the name of the free energies. Free energy is therefore the capital consumed by all creatures of all kinds, and by its conversion everything is done. This led him to formulate his energetic imperative, Vergeude keine Energie, verwerte sie. Do not waste any energy, make it useful. Three quotations illustrate how Ostwald's followers have been restating his conclusions, and how some of them have made the link between energy and all human affairs even more deterministically explicit. In the early 1970s, Howard Odum, 1924 through 2002, offered a variation on Ostwald's key theme. The availability of power sources determines the amount of work activity that can exist, and control of these power flows determines the power in man's affairs and in his relative influence on nature. In the late 1980s, Ronald Fox concluded a book on energy and evolution by writing that a refinement in cultural mechanisms has occurred with every refinement of energy-flux coupling. One does not have to be a scientist to make the link between energy supply and social advances. This is Eric Blair, George Orwell, 1903 through 1950, writing in 1937 in the second chapter of The Road to Wigan Pier after his visit to an underground coal mine. Our civilization, Paisley Chesterton, is founded on coal more completely than one realizes until one stops to think about it. The machines that keep us alive and the machines that make machines are all directly or indirectly dependent upon coal. In the metabolism of the Western world, the coal miner is second in importance only to the man who plows the soil. He is a sort of caryatid upon whose shoulders nearly everything that is not grimy is supported. For this reason, the actual process by which coal is extracted is well worth watching if you get the chance and are willing to take the trouble. But restating that fundamental link, as Orwell did, and claiming that cultural refinements have taken place with every refinement of energy flux, as Fox does, are two different things. Orwell's conclusion is unexceptionable. Fox's phrasing is clearly a restatement of a deterministic view expressed two generations earlier by the anthropologist Leslie White, 1900 through 1975, who called it the first important law of cultural development. Other things being equal, the degree of cultural development varies directly as the amount of energy per capita per year harnessed and put to work. While there can be no dispute either about Ostwald's fundamental formulation or about energy's all-encompassing effect on the structure and dynamics of evolving societies, Paisley Orwell, a deterministic linking of the level of energy use with cultural achievements is a highly arguable proposition. I examine that causality, or the lack of it, in the book's closing chapter. The fundamental nature of the concept is not in doubt. As Robert Lindsay put it, if we can find a single word to represent an idea which applies to every element in our existence in a way that makes us feel we have a genuine grasp of it, we have achieved something economical and powerful. This is what has happened with the idea expressed by the word energy. No other concept has so unified our understanding of experience. But what is energy? Surprisingly, even Nobel Prize winners have great difficulty in giving a satisfactory answer to that seemingly simple question. In his famous Lectures on Physics, Richard Feynman, 1918 through 1988, stressed that it is important to realize that in physics today we have no knowledge of what energy is. We do not have a picture that energy comes in little blobs of a definite amount. What we do know is that all matter is energy at rest, that energy manifests itself in a multitude of ways, and that these distinct energy forms are linked by numerous conversions, many of them universal, ubiquitous, and incessant, others highly localized, infrequent, and ephemeral. The understanding of these stores, potentials, and transformations was rapidly expanded and systematized mostly during the 19th century, and this knowledge was perfected during the 20th century when, a telling comment on the complexities of energy transformations, we understood how to release nuclear energy sooner, theoretically by the late 1930s, practically by 1943, when the first reactor began to operate, than we knew how photosynthesis works. Its sequences were unraveled only during the 1950s. Flows, stores, and controls. All known forms of energy are critical for human existence, a reality precluding any rank ordering of their importance. Much in the course of history has been determined and circumscribed by both universal and planetary flows of energy, and by their regional or local manifestations. The fundamental features of the universe are governed by gravitational energy, which orders countless galaxies and star systems. Gravity also keeps our planet orbiting at just the right distance from the sun, and it holds a sufficiently massive atmosphere that makes Earth habitable. As with all active stars, fusion powers the sun, and the product of those thermonuclear reactions reaches Earth as electromagnetic, solar, radiant energy. Its flux ranges over a broad spectrum of wavelengths, including visible light. About 30% of this enormous flow is reflected by clouds and surfaces, about 20% is absorbed by the atmosphere and clouds, and the remainder, roughly half of the total inflow, is absorbed by oceans and continents, gets converted to thermal energy, and is re-radiated into space. The geothermal energy of Earth adds up to a much smaller heat flux. It results from the original gravitational accretion of the planetary mass and from the decay of radioactive matter, and it drives grand tectonic processes which keep reordering oceans and continents and cause volcanic eruptions and earthquakes. Gravity and the habitability of Earth. Extreme tolerances of carbon-based metabolism are determined by the freezing point of water, whose liquid form is required for the formation and reactions of organic molecules, the lower bound, and by temperatures and pressures that destabilize amino acids and break down proteins, the upper bound. Earth's continuously habitable zone, the range of orbital radius ensuring optimal conditions for a life-supporting planet, is very narrow. A recent calculation concluded that we are even closer to the limit than previously thought. Koparapu and co-workers concluded that, given its atmospheric composition and pressure, Earth orbits at the inner edge of the habitable zone, just outside the radius where the runaway greenhouse effect would bring intolerably high temperatures. About 2 billion years ago, enough carbon dioxide, CO2, was sequestered by the ocean and by archaea and algae to prevent this effect on Earth. But if the planet had been a mere 1% farther from the sun, virtually all of its water would have been locked in glaciers. And even with temperatures within an optimum band, the planet could not support highly diversified life without its unique atmosphere, dominated by nitrogen, enriched by oxygen from photosynthesis, and containing a number of important trace gases regulating surface temperature. But this thin, gaseous envelope could not persist without the planet being sufficiently large to exert enough gravity to hold the atmosphere in place. Only a tiny part of the incoming radiant energy, less than 0.05%, is transformed by photosynthesis into new stores of chemical energy in plants, providing the irreplaceable foundation for all higher life. Animate metabolism reorganizes nutrients into growing tissues and maintains bodily functions and constant temperature in all higher species. Digestion also generates the mechanical, kinetic energy of working muscles. In their energy conversions, animals are inherently limited by the size of their bodies and by the availability of accessible nutrition. A fundamental distinguishing characteristic of our species has been the extension of these physical limits through a more efficient use of muscles and through the harnessing of energies outside our own bodies. Unlocked by human intellect, these extrasomatic energies have been used for a growing variety of tasks, both as more powerful prime movers and as fuels whose combustion releases heat. The triggers of energy supplies depend on the flow of information and on an enormous variety of artifacts. These devices have ranged from such simple tools as hammer stones and levers to complex fuel-burning engines and reactors releasing the energy of nuclear fission. The basic evolutionary and historical sequence of these advances is easy to outline in broad qualitative terms. As with any non-photosynthesizing organism, the most fundamental human energy need is for food. Foraging and scavenging by hominins were very familiar to the food acquisition practices of their primate ancestors. Although some primates, as well as a few other mammals, including otters and elephants, some birds, ravens and parrots, and even some invertebrates, cephalopods, have evolved a small repertory of rudimentary tool-using capabilities, only hominins made tool-making a distinguishing mark of their behavior. Tools have given us a mechanical advantage in the acquisition of food, shelter, and clothing. The mastery of fire greatly extended our range of habitation and set us further apart from animals. New tools led to the harnessing of domesticated animals, the building of more complex muscle-powered machines, and the conversion of a tiny fraction of the kinetic energies of wind and water to useful power. These new prime movers multiplied the power under human command, but for a very long time their use was circumscribed by the nature and magnitude of the captured flows. Most obviously, this was the case with sails, ancient and effective tools, whose capabilities were restricted for millennia by prevailing wind flows and persistent ocean currents. These grand flows steered the late 15th century European transatlantic voyages to the Caribbean. They also prevented the Spaniards from discovering Hawaii, even though Spanish trading ships, the Manila Galleons, Galeón de Manila, sailed once or twice a year across the Pacific from Mexico, Acapulco, to the Philippines for 250 years between 1565 and 1815. Controlled combustion in fireplaces, stoves, and furnaces turned the chemical energy of plants into thermal energy. This heat has been used directly in households and in smelting metals, firing bricks, and processing and finishing countless products. The combustion of fossil fuels made all of these traditional direct uses of heat more widespread and more efficient. A number of fundamental inventions made it possible to convert thermal energy from the burning of fossil fuels to mechanical energy. This was done first in steam and internal combustion engines, then in gas turbines and rockets. We have been generating electricity by burning fossil fuels, as well as by harnessing the kinetic energy of water, since 1882, and by fissioning a uranium isotope since 1956. The combustion of fossil fuels and the generation of electricity created a new form of high-energy civilization whose expansion has now encompassed the whole planet and whose primary energy sources now include small but rapidly rising shares of new renewable sources, especially solar, harnessed by photovoltaic devices or in concentrating solar power plants, and wind, converted by large wind turbines. In turn, these advances have been predicated on a concatenation of other developments. To use a flow model analogy, a combination of gates, valves, had to be set up and activated in proper sequence to enable the flow of human ingenuity. The most notable gates required to release great energy potentials include requisite educational opportunities, predictable legal arrangements, transparent economic rules, the adequate availability of capital, and conditions conducive to basic research. Not surprisingly, it usually takes generations to allow much increased or qualitatively improved energy flows or to harness entirely new sources of energy on a significant scale. Timing, overall power, and the composition of the resulting energy flows are exceedingly difficult to predict, and during the earliest phases of such transitions it is impossible to appraise all eventual impacts that changing prime movers and fuel bases will have on farming, industries, transport, settlements, warfare, and the Earth's environment. Quantitative accounts are essential to appreciate the constraints of our actions and the extent of our achievements, and they require knowledge of basic scientific concepts and measures. Concepts and Measures. Several first principles underlie all energy conversions. Every form of energy can be turned into heat or thermal energy. No energy is ever lost in any of these conversions. Conservation of energy, the first law of thermodynamics, is one of the most fundamental universal realities. But as we move along conversion chains, the potential for useful work steadily diminishes. This inexorable reality defines the second law of thermodynamics, and entropy is the measure associated with this loss of useful energy. While the energy content of the universe is constant, conversions of energies increase its entropy, decrease its utility. A basketful of grain or a barrel full of crude oil is a low entropy source of energy, capable of much useful work once metabolized or burned, and it ends up as the random motion of slightly heated air molecules, an irreversible high entropy state that represents an irretrievable loss of utility. This unidirectional entropic dissipation leads to a loss of complexity and to greater disorder and homogeneity in any closed system. But all living organisms, whether the smallest bacteria or a global civilization, temporarily defy this trend by importing and metabolizing energy. This means that every living organism must be an open system, maintaining a continuous inflow and outflow of energy and matter. As long as they are alive, these systems cannot be in a state of chemical and thermodynamic equilibrium. Their negentropy, their growth, renewal, and evolution, results in greater heterogeneity and increasing structural and systemic complexity. As with so many other scientific advances, a coherent understanding of these realities came only during the 19th century, when the rapidly evolving disciplines of physics, chemistry, and biology found a common concern in studying transformations of energy. These fundamental interests needed a codification of standard measurements. Two units became common for measuring energy: calorie, a metric unit, and the British thermal unit, BTU. Today's basic scientific unit of energy is the joule, named after an English physicist, James Prescott Joule, 1818 through 1889, who published the first accurate calculation of the equivalence of work and heat. Power denotes the rate of energy flow. Its first standard unit, horsepower, was set by James Watt, 1736 through 1819. He wanted to charge for his steam engines on a readily understandable basis, and so he chose the obvious comparison with the prime mover they were to replace, a harnessed horse commonly used to power a mill or a pump. Another important rate is energy density, the amount of energy per unit mass of a resource. This value is of a critical importance for foodstuffs. Even where abundant, low-energy density foods could never become staples. For example, The pre-Hispanic inhabitants of the basin of Mexico always ate plenty of prickly pears, which were easy to gather from the many species of cacti belonging to the genus Opuntia. But, as with most fruits, pears' pulp is overwhelmingly, about 88% water, with less than 10% carbohydrates, 2% protein, and 0.5% lipids, and has an energy density of just 1.7 megajoules per kilogram. This means that even a small woman surviving only on the carbohydrates of cactus pears, assuming unrealistically virtually no need for the other two macronutrients, would have to eat 5 kilograms of the fruit every day, but she could get the same amount of energy from only about 650 grams of ground corn consumed as tortillas or tamales. Measuring energy and power. The official definition of a joule is the work accomplished when a force of 1 newton acts over a distance of 1 meter. Another option is to define a basic energy unit through heat requirements. 1 calorie is the amount of heat needed to raise the temperature of 1 cubic centimeter of water by 1 degree Celsius. That is a tiny amount of energy. To do the same for 1 kilogram of water calls for 1,000 times more energy, or 1 kilocalorie. Given the equivalence of heat and work, all that is required to convert calories to joules is to remember that 1 calorie equals roughly 4.2 joules. The conversion is equally simple for the still common non-metric English measure, the British thermal unit. 1 BTU contains roughly 1,000 joules. 1,055 to be exact. A good comparative yardstick is the average daily food need. For most moderately active adults, it is 2 to 2.7 megacals, or about 8 to 11 megajoules, and 10 megajoules could be supplied by eating 1 kilogram of whole wheat bread. In 1782, James Watt calculated in his Blotting and Calculation book that a mill horse works at a rate of 32,400 foot-pounds a minute, and the next year he rounded this to 33,000 foot-pounds. He assumed an average walking speed of about 3 feet per second, but we do not know where he got his figure for an average pull of about 180 pounds. Some large animals were that powerful, but most horses in 18th-century Europe could not sustain the rate of 1 horsepower. Today's standard unit of power, 1 watt, is equal to the flow of 1 joule per second. 1 horsepower is equal to about 750 watts, 745.699 to be exact. Consuming 8 megajoules of food a day corresponds to a power rate of 90 watts. 8 megajoules per 24 hours times 3,600 seconds. Less than the rating of a standard light bulb, 100 watts. A double toaster needs 1,000 watts, or 1 kilowatt. Small cars deliver around 50 kilowatts. A large coal-fired or nuclear power plant produces electricity at the rate of 2 gigawatts. Power density is the rate at which energies are produced or consumed per unit of area, and hence is a critical structural determinant of energy systems. For example, city size in all traditional societies depended on fuel wood and charcoal, and it was clearly limited by the inherently low power density of phytomass production. The power density of sustainable annual tree growth in temperate climates is at best equal to 2% of the power density of energy consumption for traditional urban heating, cooking, and manufactures. Consequently, cities had to draw on nearby areas of at least 30 times their size for fuel supply. This reality restricted their growth, even where other resources, such as food and water, were adequate. Yet another rate, one that has assumed great importance with advancing industrialization, is the efficiency of energy conversions. This ratio of output-input describes the performance of energy converters, be they stoves, engines, or lights. While we cannot do anything about the entropic dissipation, we can improve the efficiency of conversions by lowering the amount of energy required to perform specific tasks. There are fundamental, thermodynamic, mechanical, constraints to these improvements, but we have pushed some processes close to the practical efficiency.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?